Since we didn't record last week and we were asked to record, I thought I'd give a brief overview and review of what we looked at in continuing the topic. Last week we discussed the origin and the form of angels, and we don't want to linger too much or rehash too much. But for the benefit of those who may not have been able to join us or for those who may be listening in, just a very quick review regarding angels, their origin, and their form. We looked at and had started our study by asking, are angels eternal? That is, have angels always existed, or at some point in time did they come into being? And we looked at a couple of passages, the first of which, Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created that are in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him. And Nehemiah 9:6, you alone are the Lord, you have made the heaven of heavens, with all their hosts, the earth and everything on it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve them all. The hosts of heaven worship you. And we looked at how those hosts of heaven were those angelic beings. And then Nehemiah credits God with created the heavens and the hosts of heaven. So we were able to determine angels are created beings. They have not always existed. They were created by God. And we looked at what point in time might they be created. One passage that we really examined, Job 38:4-7, when God is speaking to Job, and you can reference this if you like, but it comes down to the fact that God speaking there says that when he laid the foundations of the earth, the angels sang with joy at the laying of the foundation of the earth. So we see that they were created, yet they were there when the earth was created. So the only conclusion that we can really draw, the biblical answer that we can draw regarding the question when angels were created, was at some point in time before the creation of the world, and we really don't want to go any further than that. We looked at angels being moral, free moral agents, that is, they have opportunities to make decisions, free will, just like we have. We looked at those angels in 2 Peter 2:4, who chose to transgress the domain that God set for them. Because they made the decision to sin and do that, they were cast down to hell and delivered into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment. I was having a conversation with one of the members regarding angels in this particular topic, and he pointed out how he found it interesting that it doesn't appear for angels, unlike us, when we sin, for us there is a second law of pardon. There's an opportunity for us to make what we have done right through Jesus Christ. However, there doesn't appear to be anything like that that we're told, at least, in Scripture. There doesn't appear to be that second law of pardon for angels, so that was kind of an interesting conversation. Regarding their form, we saw that they are spiritual beings, invisible to the unaided eye, most frequently appearing as men, but sometimes taking other forms, depending on the nature of the work that God had them do. So that's our class last week in a nutshell. This week what we're going to be looking at is the nature and attributes of angels. That is, what are those characteristics that really define angels? Now, I think we're going to have a good study. One of the things we found out, the first thing we're going to look at, and we're going to kind of devote off of this after we examine this point, there in Matthew 22:30, we've referenced this passage a couple of times regarding angels, and I'd like to correct the statement that I made last week, and then we're going to take further look at another passage in the Old Testament. We're going to spend a good amount of our time this morning on that. And I regret that Brother Robert, I don't see him in here this morning. He and I had a discussion. He actually prompted me to include this, so I chose to after having that visit with him regarding a topic we're going to look at in just a second. But I think I said last week, or I made a statement of to the effect of angels not having a gender, based off of this passage here in Matthew 22:30. Now, the context of the passage, the Sadducees come up to Jesus, they're questioning Jesus, and they ask him, if a man marries a wife, an oldest brother takes a wife, he dies, passes her on to the next brother with no children, so forth, so on, seven times, in the resurrection, whose wife is she going to be? And what we emphasize regarding angels for our study is what Jesus says in Matthew 22:30. In the resurrection, speaking of angels, or speaking of the sons of the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels of God in heaven. So based off of this statement and given the answer to the Sadducees, we can draw the conclusion that angels are unmarriageable, or that they do not marry and are not given in marriage. What Jesus is demonstrating here is that marriage is not a state, that exists beyond this life. Marriage is not a state that exists beyond this life. You can go look at Romans chapter 7, verse 2. You know, Paul makes that statement regarding the law of Moses and regarding the woman who was free to marry. The woman who has her husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So if her husband dies, she is once again free to remarry. Marriage is a relationship that exists on this earth. Now, I made the statement and drew the conclusion, and I think probably a little presumptuously, that based off the fact that angels are married, that they do not also have a gender. I believe I made that statement. If not, that was the opinion that I had. But as I've said before, we need to stick to the study of God's Word. Just a statement that I came across, I share this with you. This was made by someone who also is apparently of this opinion. There are no males or females in the spirit world, and those who inherit eternal life are as angels in heaven. That is, they have all those qualities of spirit that belong to angels and have dropped all those human relations and propensities. They are without the passions of the flesh, are pure celestial beings, and immortal. Now, while that may sound fairly good, I do believe that it's taking a step outside of what Jesus tells us here in Matthew 22:30. What does Jesus say regarding angels in Matthew 22:30? Scripture tells us that they just don't marry. There's nothing there about them losing or not having any gender. That's a conclusion that we might draw based off of this statement, but it's not what Jesus says. The statement Jesus makes here that's clear in Matthew 22:30 is that angels do not engage in that relationship of marriage. Marriage is a relationship that exists in this physical plane, but it is not one that extends to the eternal plane. However, Jesus says nothing at all about a loss of gender or a change in gender. In fact, you go look at 1 John chapter 3 and verse 2, John says, "It's not yet been revealed what we shall be." So there's, as I said, there's a lot of unanswerable questions, and I think that this is one of those. Now, with that in mind, I'd like to look at Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6, we've looked at this particular attribute and particular aspect of their nature, that they don't marry, and they are given in marriage. And so I'd like to spend a few minutes discussing a potential reference to angels, and I believe that this is somewhat relevant to our discussion. A potential reference to angels is found in Genesis chapter 6. Could I get you to read Genesis 6 verses 1 and 2 and verse 4, please? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Alive.
And it came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and the daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of which they chose. Verse 4. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in, to the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old men of renown.
Okay, we're just going to wait off all up in the middle of this in Genesis chapter 6. In Genesis 6, do you think that there's a possibility that the sons of God that are being spoken up here are angels? Okay. And I would agree with that. There is a possibility. What we're really going to take a few moments of our time this morning to do is, because that is a possibility, because we looked at the fact that although angels do not marry, we don't necessarily see that they do not have a gender, we're going to take a few minutes to entertain that as a possible interpretation of this passage in Genesis 6. In fact, this is probably one of the first interpretations that was taken and applied to this passage, speaking of the sons of God and the daughters of men. And essentially what I want to do, because, and I'm going to say this as I've said before, I don't believe the Bible is going to give us a clear-cut answer. And I don't think we're going to be able to say beyond a shadow of a doubt that yes, this is angels, or no, this was not angels. However, there are two primary interpretations to this text. One of those being that the sons of God were angels, that they came and that took these wives and had these children, and this offspring, this giant offspring, were the result of those relationships. So we're going to just take a few minutes to present those two views. And I'm going to just provide the information to you and allow you to draw your own conclusion. And like I say, I do believe that there are many people that interpret this to be angels, and so that's why we're taking the time to kind of go off on this rabbit trail, as it does pertain possibly to our discussion of angels. First off, notice that there seems to be a similarity between what Moses is giving an account of in this particular action that takes place, this sin, this transgression that occurs in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 2, and the nature of Eve's sin back in Genesis 3. And I'll show you what I mean as you can kind of parallel these two passages. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves of all whom they chose. And this is what's spoken of whenever Eve sees the fruit. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. So there seems to be some similarity between the sins of the sons of God in Genesis 6 and the sin that Eve committed back in Genesis 3 with the eating of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now, I said there are primarily two perspectives and interpretations to this passage in Genesis 6 regarding these sons of God that are talking about. Now, the more traditional interpretation, the one that's taken by a lot of Christians today, is the understanding that this was a religiously mixed races view. And we'll explain these fleshes out, and then we're going to show some supporting evidence and some evidence where these arguments are weaker. And once again, I just want to provide you with evidence and allow you to draw that conclusion on your own as to what this might be. If you consider this idea that these sons of God, this can have a literal interpretation. But you might also say that this phrase, son of, is something that doesn't have to be taken literally. It could simply mean that they are characteristically similar. We are children of God by adoption. And whenever we refer to or are referred to as sons of God, that doesn't mean that we are literal, connected sons of God in the physical means, but rather that we exhibit those characteristics that God first demonstrated: holiness, righteousness, just, kindness, forgiveness. We are sons of God through our characteristics that link us together. And so, therefore, in that sense, we are sons of God. And the daughters of men, this particular view suggests that the sons of God are simply righteous individuals who possess characteristics that are similar to God, and they go and they marry daughters of men. And once again, not necessarily literal daughters, but you have mankind who at this point in time is becoming wicked and evil, and therefore the characteristics of those women that they intermarried with were that of evil. And it really is traced back to Genesis 4 and 5. If you read Genesis 4 and 5, which we're not going to do, you have there the genealogy of Seth and the genealogy of Cain. Now you look at those two genealogies and certain things stand out to you. It's obvious that Cain's generation was quite evil. And it's obvious that Seth's generation, on the other hand, was righteous. And so the interpretation that many people draw based off of this text in Genesis 6 is that the sons of God was the lineage of Seth who intermarried with the lineage of Cain, and as a result of that, this wickedness, great wickedness, came upon the earth. That's one of the primary interpretations of this sons of God in Genesis 6. Sethites marrying the Cainites, and as a result of that, the wickedness within began to ensue. Now, there is support for this interpretation, one of which being that it best fits the context that's being recorded in Genesis. As I said in chapters 4 and 5, you've got there the lineage of Seth, you've got there the lineage of Cain, and so it makes sense for it to occur right after those two lineages are mentioned that this intermarrying takes place. And so interpreting this as sons of men being the lineage of sons of God being the righteous lineage of Seth fits in with the context of what the writer of Genesis, Moses, has mentioned up until this point in time. As a result of the wickedness that occurs, you read later on in Genesis 6 that God decides to destroy the earth with a flood. What we also find out is, in support of this argument, is that it reinforces the Mosaic law that was given in Deuteronomy chapter 7 and verse 3. And you may remember what that is. Essentially, that the Israelites were only to marry Israelites. They weren't to take and marry any of the heathen women. And those who look at this argument and try to support this argument, interpreting the sons of God to be the lineage of Seth, say, well, Moses is reinforcing in the mind of the children of Israel the importance of staying true to who you are supposed to marry, which was in accordance with the law that God gave in Deuteronomy 7 and 3. However, while we may like this interpretation because it fits in our mind and it makes more sense than our logical mind, which we have a tendency, perhaps most of the time, to push away from the supernatural and the abnormal, and we like this argument here because it's talking about men, and that makes more sense than talking about angels. There are arguments that are made against this particular interpretation, and just to be fair, we want to speak of what those are. For one, in verses 1 and 2 of Genesis 6, the term men there is used differently. It's used differently in verse 1 than it is used in verse 2. In verse 1, it's used regarding mankind as a whole, a generic mankind. Now in verse 2, to stay true to this interpretation, you have to change the meaning of that same Hebrew word to therefore refer to a specific lineage, the lineage of Seth. And the context doesn't necessarily give us a reason to do that. This is one of the arguments used against this interpretation, being the sons of God being of the lineage of Seth. And another being, and this is really where I would have trouble defending this argument, why would a religiously mixed marriage produce giants? You can read verse 4, and we included verse 4 for that reason, because as Moses is writing this down, it's obvious that this intermarrying that takes place, these giants are a product of that sons of God, daughters of men relationship. And so one would have to wonder, why would these giants be a result of these religiously mixed marriages? That doesn't really make a lot of sense. Comments, questions on this particular interpretation, sons of God, in Genesis 6. Tommy? Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Right. Okay, well, I believe sons of God probably has a more, not just spiritual being, because as we're going to find out next week, we're going to study the classification of angels. But sons of God, I find in reference to angels. Now, spiritual beings, I would say specifically sons of God are described as angels. That's how I would interpret that. And so I would probably interpret that particular phrase, not as necessarily a spiritual being, but rather as an angel. But you do bring out a good point, and we're going to look at that a little more in depth in the next argument. The other one being, and this one more so pertaining to our discussion of angels, this is essentially, the argument is called the cosmologically mixed races view. And essentially this understanding or interpretation is the sons of God are angels that left their proper abode and married these human women. There are, and as Tommy mentioned, in favor of this argument, this phrase sons of God that is frequently used in the Old Testament, most typically, it refers to angels or spiritual beings. And so that would be in favor of this argument that the sons of God here, once again, carrying true with Old Testament language, the writer here is talking about these spiritual beings that came down and had relationships with these women. Because very frequently, sons of God do refer to angels or spiritual beings of some nature. Oftentimes, another argument used to support this interpretation, that these are angels we're talking about, they came down and married with these women, is the possible attempt that the writer is making to correct a pagan supposition. Now, there is an old pagan memory that essentially was if that these gods came down and married these women, and as a result of that, their offspring, these giants, were semi-divine, semi-god beings. And some have said, well, what Moses is seeking to do is to correct that pagan idea and give an account historically of what actually happened. No, that they're not sons of semi-god people, but rather that they were the spawn of fallen angels. Some people have made that argument. And what I find interesting, though, is that there are several Bible passages that might support this view, depending on how you interpret them. Those being 1 Peter 3:18 through 20, 2 Peter 2:4 through 6, and Jude verse 6. Now, you can make note of those, and I see we're running short on time, but you can make note of those. And look at those in a little more detail. We'll just look at one. I'm going to look at 2 Peter chapter 2, 4 through 6. And we'll try to get done looking at this and get back on track with the rest of our study regarding angels and their attributes. In 2 Peter chapter 2, 4 through 6, this is what Peter records for us. If God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into the chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and he did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood of the world and the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who would afterward live ungodly. So you have there Peter's account, and this is a possible way to look at it as being supportive of the sons of God being angels, because Peter lists there three events. He lists the flood, which we can definitely trace back to Genesis 6. He mentions Lot, who we can trace back to Genesis chapter 22, where Sodom is destroyed. So really all that's left, he mentions among those two also, these angels that have sinned, and that God has cast out from heaven to be reserved for the power for judgment. Now, it would make sense that if Peter's listed two other events that have occurred in the book of Genesis, possibly he's also referencing what is spoken about and written about in Genesis 6, where these sons of God might be these angels that sin and that God cast out. So, depending on how you interpret that, you can make an argument, and also from 1 Peter 3:18 through 20, in Jude 6, angels that did not keep their proper abode, that abode being heaven, them leaving heaven and going and marrying to marry with these women, that could have been possibly the condemnation that was brought about on those angels that chose not to keep their proper abode. So there are arguments in favor of this sons of God being angels there. Now, we don't want to linger too long in regard to arguments against that. I wish we could have spent an entire class looking at this. But arguments against that being angels there, the Son of God doesn't refer exclusively to angels. There are times where, in our Old Testament, where that phrase, sons of God, is used describing men. And I had a couple of passages, if you'd like to record these. Isaiah 43:6 and Hosea 1:10, where sons of God are used in reference to humans. So, as we mentioned, it does frequently refer to angels. It's not exclusively referring to angels when this term is used. Another strong argument that this interpretation has against it, Jesus did say in Matthew 22:30, angels do not marry. They are not given in marriage. And you go back and read Genesis 6, 1 and 2, that's where it's taking place. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, and they took them as wife. That's what you've got taking place there in Genesis 6. Jesus said angels don't marry. That's an argument that's not necessarily in favor of that. And then lastly, if angels, the sons of God, if angels were the source of this evil, you go and read through the rest of the chapter, the flood is the ensuing event that occurs because of the evil that was across the earth. If angels were the cause or the source of this evil, then why is God destroying mankind? Why does judgment fall on man whenever the angels were the source of this? Because they were the one who took the daughters of women, married, and then the great evil then came upon the world. So essentially you've got those two views regarding the interpretation of the sons of man, sons of God and daughters of men there in Genesis 6. Well, they've been angels, and that's why we took such a large part of our class to look at that. Any comments or questions before we move on? Okay, we've got 5 minutes, 10 minutes to look at the rest of these attributes. So I apologize, we lingered a little longer on that than I would have liked. But back to angels, their nature, their attributes. They can't marry, as you very well know. We also see angels possess somewhat of a superior knowledge to humans. Speaking of angels here, and I believe this is one of the generals of David coming, says, my Lord is wise according to the wisdom of the angel of God to know everything that is in the earth. You know, and I think also back to Satan in Job 1, who is walking back and forth on the face of the earth, able to be there and travel the earth and traverse the earth in a way that surpasses what a human would be capable of doing. So it seems like angels do have somewhat of a superior knowledge. But we also need to be aware that while their knowledge may be superior to that which man is able to have, at the same time, it's somewhat limited. That is, it is less than the knowledge or the omniscience that God has. Matthew 24:36, regarding the destruction of Jerusalem, what does Jesus say about the timing of that and the end of the age that would be coming? Who knows? Okay, only the Father That means the angels, although they had the superior knowledge, the angels did not know. And Peter in 1 Peter 1:12, speaking of the new covenant, God's bringing Jesus into the world, saving both Jew and Gentile, he says that information is things which angels even desired to look into. Angels themselves wanted to know, but that wasn't to be revealed at that point in time. So although they've got a superior knowledge to humans, they don't necessarily have omniscience, that is all knowledge, knowing all things, that is a characteristic of deity. And we're also going to find out another characteristic of angels is they have superior power. And I think Johnny mentioned this in the first class that he taught whenever I was here, the first Sunday I was here. And again, in Isaiah chapter 37, this is where Sennacherib and the Assyrian army is threatening to destroy the army of Israel. You remember what God did because of the boasting of Sennacherib and his pride? So he destroyed the entire army. 185,000 Assyrians died in a night at the hands of one angel. So angels definitely possess, being spiritual beings, being servants of God, possess a superior knowledge and a superior power to humans. And that's 1 Thessalonians 1, 6 through 9. That references the coming of Jesus, where it's going to be the shout, the voice of an archangel. Jesus and the angels are going to descend. So the angels are going to be there when Jesus comes in judgment. One angel is able to destroy an entire Assyrian army. They thus possess superior power and superior knowledge than human beings. Revelation chapter 22, verses 8 and 9. However, despite the fact they do possess the superior power and the superior knowledge, we find there that, and we need to be aware, because there are people, there are denominations, and there are teachers that worship angels. Because of, as we've seen, they possess characteristics similar to that of deity and greater than that of humans. And so it may be a tendency of some people to worship these angels. However, you look at Revelation 22, 8 and 9, this angel has come and has spoken to John. He's mighty in power. He possesses this knowledge superior to that of John. John saw it, and said, "I saw and I heard these things, and when I heard and when I saw it, I fell down to worship before the feet of the angel who showed me these things." And it's been the propensity of some through the years to engage in worship of angels because they are greater than man, in a sense. However, the angel replies, and what we need to take away from this, the angel says, "See that you don't do that. For I am your fellow servant, and of your brethren, and the prophets, and those who keep the words of this book, worship God." So this angel says, "Hey, I'm just a fellow servant. You worship God. You don't direct worship toward me." So despite the fact that they're greater in knowledge and power, they are beings that are to be worshipped. Now, we'll conclude with this particular point regarding the nature and the attributes of angels. And I've mentioned this, I believe, at the introduction to our class. The angels take a particular, unique interest in the salvation of man. And we looked at those two passages. We're only going to really look at the third. But in Luke 2:13, what's the event that Luke records for us there regarding the birth of the Messiah? What were the angels doing whenever Jesus was born? Okay, rejoicing. And those people that try to reenact the Christmas scene, the birth of Jesus, and they apply that to the time of December 25th, that particular detail, they're correct in doing. The angels are rejoicing at the birth of Jesus. Now, why might they be? Because salvation was coming into the world. Salvation was going to be brought about and be fulfilled through Jesus and through His birth. This time in God's plan is beginning to unfold. And through Jesus and His work, men were going to be able to be saved. And so the angels rejoiced not that Jesus left the splendor and glory of heaven, but rather that this process of God accomplishing man's salvation was starting with Jesus' birth. And we look at another passage in Luke 15, verses 4 through 10. Where we got there is Jesus talking about the lost coin, the lost sheep, and then the lost son, the prodigal son. And in each of those instances, he says that whenever the one who found, they lost that thing, whenever they found that, there was rejoicing with the angels in heaven. And what he's demonstrating is that renewal, that person who has been spiritually found, who's returned to God, the angels rejoice because they do appear to have an interest in the salvation of man. Now, go ahead and turn to Luke chapter 22:43. We will look at this passage in closing. And following along with this theme and this characteristic they just possess, that they've got this interest in man's salvation. What do we have taking place in Luke chapter 22? Where's Jesus at? What? Okay, he's in the garden. And Jesus is praying because he knows his time is near. What have his disciples been doing? Okay, so his disciples who previously been with him and have supported him in his work, and Jesus now finds himself at the most emotionally draining moment of his life, this impending doom that's hanging over his head, his death on the cross, that he knows is coming. Now more than ever, he needs their support. Now more than ever, he needs their encouragement, perhaps, if you can envision it. Because Jesus is a man, he takes on those qualifications, and this is the wonderful thing about having that Messiah who was made as we were. He dealt with the emotional pressure that was hanging over his head at that point in time. His disciples can't stay awake. His disciples are falling asleep, and he's gone to them as this, you know, pray with me. Pray that you might not enter into temptation. And they don't really fall asleep. The third time he goes and he prays by himself. Luke 22:43, an angel, and while he's praying, and this is in the midst of his sweat, his great drops of blood, while he's there in that emotionally driven state, an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. Jesus' purpose, that salvation of man, is soon to be fulfilled. He's in deep agony, he's in emotional distress, his disciples aren't anywhere to be found, they're all sleeping. And he's praying to God, not my will, but yours. Now, would Jesus have been able to persist in his task and accomplish what God intended for him? I would say yes. But what do we see an angel doing there in that particular event? Strengthening him. He was going in his strength to endure the cross. He was going in his strength to endure the mocking and the scourging and the terrible death that he was soon going to experience. Well, I said, and this is in relation to angels having an interest in man's salvation, that's what's on the line right here. Jesus is God, but he's also man, and he's dealing with deep distress. That's what's on the line if he were unable to find the strength to continue with God's plan. Now, I don't believe that Jesus would have failed in his mission had this not happened. But once again, despite that fact that's irrelevant, an angel appeared, an angel strengthens him for the task that lies ahead, that allows him to suffer and to go to the cross and to die on the cross to accomplish the salvation that you and I are able to enjoy. And as I said before, I think it's obvious from Scripture that angels are interested in man's salvation based off of those passages. Are there any comments or questions as we bring our lesson this morning to a close? Yes, sir. Question or comment? Isn't that encouraging? You look at Jesus himself, and as I said before, I don't think that there's any way that we can determine and we can say, an angel helped me here. But we're simply told there, we trust the word of God. Angels are ministering spirits. Their purpose is serving God. Their purpose is assisting saints. Now, in what way? We don't know. We may not be able to identify God on us, but we can trust in the fact that they're there. That they're servants of God, and that God is going to use them to give us strength in times of tribulation, as he did with Jesus. Now, how he's going to do that and how he's going to accomplish that, I can't know. But everything that we've looked at, the fact that there is a spiritual realm where the spiritual beings interact and it has a bearing on this physical world, we can take confidence in knowing that God is on our side and that he will send his angels, who are mighty in power, to assist us when times are difficult. How that may be, I can't say. We'll know one day. But we can trust in God's promise that he will do what he said he's going to do. Any other comments, questions? Okay, next week we're going to examine the classification and the work of angels, this is what I'm particularly excited about. I think it's very interesting to examine the classification of angels that you really break down. Tommy had mentioned, we have angels in our Bible. We're going to look at them and we've detailed our study regarding them and their work. But we're going to look at some of the other spiritual beings that we might in times past have associated with angels, but that I think we're going to see are unique in their design and their purpose, but yet are spiritual beings. So we're going to take a look at the classification and the work of those specific spiritual beings next week. So I appreciate everyone's participation and your comments in our class.